I am co-founder of Digest Publishing and publisher of Daily Profit Cycle, Mr. Nick Hodge. I am flying solo this week without my partner, friend, and co-host, Gerardo Del Real. This is the 333rd episode of Investing in Bizarro World. I'm happy to be here. I'm glad you're here. There are, in fact, several hundred of you who are now paying to be here, and I thoroughly appreciate that and hope you are getting your money's worth for $2 or less an episode, and you enjoy the things that we talk about here, the investment ideas, the trends, the state of the bizarro world, and of course, the premium portfolio picks, which are reflective of the things that investments that Gerardo and I and Mr. Chris Curl, who you heard from last week, are recommending in our premium publications. And I have an inkling that some of you are having success because there's been a couple of testimonials coming in lately. I think Gerardo and I shared some of them about private placement intel, but one came in this week from Mr. Dr. Alan G. that says, "Hi, Gerardo. I thought I would write you and Nick to thank you for having made me at least 100 times my costs for all the subscriptions I have with you guys." 100 times your subscription cost is pretty good. And so I encourage you to check out those publications at Digest Publishing. I am fresh back from a 5-state tour on the East Coast. I went to the U.S. Open. I saw Mr. Alcaraz. I went to a Philadelphia Phillies game. I saw my parents. I ate some blue crabs for the first time in a couple of years, and I sorely missed those. And now it's time to get back to work because fall is here. Pumpkin spice lattes are available at your corner Starbucks. The kids are now back in school and are scuffing up their new shoes. And conference season is here, which means we're approaching the end of drilling season and the news releases are going to ramp up significantly. And in fact, they have already. Gerardo and I will be at Beaver Creek next week. That's the Precious Metals Summit in lovely Beaver Creek, Colorado. I'm not sure how many of you will be there. That's mostly an industry conference, not a lot of retail folks there. But after that, we'll be at the New Orleans Investment Conference the first week of November. And I know that's one of Gerardo's favorite conferences. In fact, he says it is his favorite conference. We've been going every year for something like 13 years. We'll both be speaking, presenting, and we'll have a number of companies there that we've helped finance and that we're invested in. So you'll get a chance to talk directly to them, some of which I'll mention later on in this podcast. But enough rambling and wandering. Let me talk about some macro musings. And I wanted to talk about the dollar and yields and gold. So let me see if I can share my screen here. Chef Cook and Bottle Washer. Is it going to let me do it? Perhaps. Yes. Bond yields first. The top line there, the maroon line you'll see, is the U.S. 30-year yield. That's the yield on the U.S. 30-year bond. On the bottom, you'll see the U.S. 10-year yield. That's the yield on the U.S. 10-year bond. You will notice that the trend lines I have drawn are going in opposite directions. The 10-year yield is going down and to the right, and the 30-year yield is going up and to the right. Pray tell, what is going on? Well, you have a 97% chance of a rate cut here in a couple of weeks when the Fed meets for its September meeting, and they'll likely shave a quarter point off the current federal funds rate. We know, and I've told you many times, and I write about a lot in Foundational Profits, the relationship between bond yields and the dollar and growth and inflation. And if you've read some of that stuff, you would know that the Fed, that unelected body of many individuals who set rates and lie to you about inflation, is set to meet, and they're going to cut rates, and they control the short end of the curve, the short durations, the 2-year yield, the 10-year yield. Those are short ends of the curve, for example. That's why they're going down. They're anticipating a front running or pricing in that coming rate cut, and potentially subsequent rate cuts. We'll have to wait and see. The top line, the 30-year yield, is going up. Well, that's opposite from going down, if you're still with me. And that's indicative of a robust economy, of growth likely going to be in the U.S. in the GDP, looking out past September, which is historically tumultuous for stock markets, and looking past these current Fed meetings, and looking past the tit for tat or the infighting that's going on amid Mr. Trump and Mr. Besant and Mr. Powell and Ms. Cook. That's the setup for yield. Short term, bond yield cuts from the Fed. Longer term, the 30-year is telling you that there's going to be robust economic growth and that we're not in danger of a recession. So I thought that was a pretty neat little chart there. The other thing that's been happening, commensurate with bond yields in the short end going down, has been the dollar has been weak. And those two things are great tailwinds for gold. Down bond yields in the short term, down dollar strength. The other thing that's great for gold is instability or uncertainty, which we've had heaping spoonfuls of so far in Trump's administration, right? With the tariffs and the Liberation Day and the back and forth and the Supreme Court and all that stuff that you know about. So what has happened in the face of that recently is gold, since the last time I spoke with you on this podcast, has touched a new all-time record high, very close to $3,600 an ounce. In fact, future months, out months, like the December contract, for example, for gold has flashed above $3,600 an ounce. So we remain firmly entrenched in a precious metals bull market that we continue to take advantage of in our publications. And at the same time, weak yields, weak dollar is good for the stock market, which continues to be near all-time record highs. So everything continues to be awesome is what I'm saying. I think September is going to be your roughest month of the remainder of the year. Historically, if you look at the seasonality, that's true. And we're seeing that play out a little bit here ahead of the Fed meeting. As I already said, Trump threatens the independence of the Fed by wanting to fire certain members and oust Mr. Powell, which you'll likely hear more about later this week when Mr. Besant unveils the likely replacements, which I would bet are dovish. So that's the current macro musings. Let's get into market takes for a second. And I want to do something unique. One, because I'm by myself, and so I can give you a little bit of a soliloquy. And two, because I'm working on a new project with a very well-known publishing group, and they asked me to put my thoughts on video about critical minerals resources, why I'm interested in them, and what metals specifically I'm interested in. And so I'm lazy. Well, let's not say I'm lazy, because that's not true. I like to work smart and kill two birds with one stone. I have, in fact, killed two birds by throwing one rock once, but that's a story for another podcast. So I was going to use this couple of minutes here to tell you about the metals I'm bullish on and why. And I'm going to take it all the way back to the start of my career in 2007. So settle in. This will probably take 5 or 10 minutes. 2007, the stock market was absolutely ripping. That was before 2008, if you can count. And one of the groups of stocks that were leading that charge, that ascent, were clean energy stocks, solar stocks, specifically Chinese solar stocks. Some of you old enough to remember some of the names, JA Solar, Yingli, all those fun things. And I had just graduated university and wanted to write. So I answered a classified ad in Baltimore where I lived and had went to university. It was a classified ad to write, blog about, create reports about, et cetera, renewable energy. Baltimore is the center of the financial publishing universe. And, that's the ad that I applied to as a financial publisher. And I got the job. I was very young and poor and stupid and still am to some extent, that I started writing about all these clean energy stocks and became sort of an expert because it was such a new field. You'll remember that Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth was popular. We were very concerned with climate change, and by God, we were going to reduce emissions by deploying all these new clean technologies, solar, wind, geothermal, wave energy, energy efficiency, smart grid. I learned about all the things. I wrote two books about all the things investing in renewable energy, making money on green chip stocks, and then I wrote a dummies book, Energy Investing for Dummies, where I chronicled all those different technologies, et cetera. Somewhere in the mix there, the global financial crash happened, and nobody really cared about solar stocks in China anymore, as we had the TARP bailouts led by Mr. Obama at the time. And I started to wonder, remember, I was young and dumb. I was in my 20s. I started to wonder, what the hell is going on here? What, you know, what caused all this? Why did the stock market crash? Why did Lehman Brothers go out of business bankrupt so fast after having been around for over 150 years or something like that? Why are we bailing out the bankers who took the risky bets on the mortgage-backed loans and derivative products that led to all this in the first place? And that's when I began to get really disenfranchised with the system. I watched a president in Obama who you know, came to power as a common man, champion of the common man. And then I just watched him bail out the banks, right? So I started wondering, you know, about monetary policy and politics and government and the Treasury and the Fed. And then I started reading the books, right? You know, and None Dare Call It Conspiracy, A Creature from Jekyll Island, all those sort of things, figuring out sort of how the world worked. At the same time, there were several bull markets and resources happening. You know, 2009, 10, 11 were great years for gold and silver. That was obviously the last major bull run in the precious metals. Now, there was a huge rare earth run in 2010, 11. That my mentor, Jeff Phillips, was essentially the figurehead of. He had financed three of the major rare earth companies that ended up listing on major exchanges and having options listed, et cetera. And also, there was a uranium bull run that happened from 2007 to 2010 until Fukushima happened in 2011. And so I got really interested in the hard money space, the sound money, anti-fiat, gold, classical economics, Austrian economics, et cetera. And that's when I, you know, started a thing called the Outsider Club, where, you know, this whole thing, like George Carlin, is a big club and you're never going to be in it. And I focused on the hard metals, the resources, the energy metals, uranium, lithium, et cetera. And what I began to realize, I'm now up to 2013, 2014, 2015, and remember, I have a background in clean energy. What I began to realize is, you know, these natural resources are the building blocks for everything that humanity wants to do, right? Like, you want to build a solar panel? Great. Well, you need the polysilicon and the silver and the gallium and the indium. You want to build a wind turbine? Great, man. You need rare earths and tungsten and steel. Like, all that stuff's got to come out of the ground. Do you want to build a nuclear reactor? Wonderful. The only thing you can power that with is U-308. You got to mine that stuff. And so I became a champion of resources, of real things, not of technology. And I started learning more about all those things, right? Especially the North American outsourcing of the production of all those things to China. And so I want to talk about a couple of metals and why I like them so much, because that's part of this project. So uranium, I think, is probably the current most important one outside of precious metals, outside of gold. It contributes so much to so many other sectors and trends that are popular in the market right now, like artificial intelligence. It's wonderful. I use it. It's obviously powered huge stock gains in the stock market over the past 3-4 years. But you can't have artificial intelligence without the electricity. And increasingly, you're seeing all the tech companies that are building out this technology in the data centers are saying there's really no energy source that can provide what we need except for nuclear. And of course, you've seen all the announcements from Meta and Amazon on down the line that, you know, they're investing in a very real way in the build out of new nuclear capacity and the extension of existing nuclear capacity. I.e. the build out of new small modular reactors and the extension or restarting of existing nuclear plants or ones that are shuttered, like Three Mile Island. At the same time, you know, the U.S. needs something like, I don't know, 50 million pounds of uranium a year to power all those reactors. There's 90 some of them in the United States. But we produce only like 1 million pounds, right? So we produce 1 million and we need 50. I'm going to start cussing now. Where the fuck is the rest of the uranium going to come from when, like, Kazakhstan produces 45% of the world's uranium and they're an arm of the Russian state, which the entire world is seemingly against right now? So that's it for powering data centers and artificial intelligence. Let's get back to my knitting, to my roots, clean energy. Why would we build inefficient solar panels that don't have storage capabilities right now when we have a proven technology in nuclear that's, by the way, the safest source of electricity generation the world, humanity, has ever seen in terms of deaths or injuries per kilowatt hour of electricity generated? Why wouldn't we be pursuing nuclear full bore, especially because, again, I've been doing clean energy since 2007, we haven't reduced our emissions with the other pathways that were tried before. Global emissions continue to rise, certainly in Asian countries. And so the only viable solution to reduce your emissions and still have baseload power and have your lights on is a massive nuclear build out. And we've been crescendoing toward that. Over the past couple of years, there was a setback because of Fukushima, but now even the majority in Japan, if you look at the sentiment polls, want new nuclear reactors, and they have been turning them back on. So, and again, uranium is a tough mineral to find, identify, and exploit economic deposits of. There's only a couple of geographies in the world that support such deposits. Many of the mines are old and have been operating. And the East just hasn't taken the time or the capital to invest in the new mines that are going to supply all this stuff. And so there's going to be a vast catch up. It's why you've seen Trump fast track uranium projects in the American Southwest. It's why you've seen Trump make several executive orders related to nuclear and uranium fuel production. And so, you know, that's that. I've been a uranium bull for a long time, saw the writing on the wall a decade ago. And have made a lot of money on the road since, you know. In fact, speaking of Trump and his administration, I saw just today Encore Energy announced the fast tracking by the Trump administration of the Dewey Burdock project in South Dakota. I know a bit about the Dewey Burdock project. I financed it in 2017 and in 2018 with a company called Azarga Uranium, which we went on to make several 100% on, close to 1,000%, by doing private placements in Azarga. And then when it got bought out by Encore Energy, which is now one of the three U.S. producers of uranium, we were in this project since grassroots, again, back in 2017. And so we've been in this arena. We've made money in this arena. And now the projects that we helped finance some 8 years ago are now being fast-tracked by the presidential administration to provide the next round of uranium for the United States to generate clean energy. You putting all this together? Okay. The other metal I like is copper. Copper is predicted to have a structural supply deficit, you know, for many years to come. It's largely produced by South America, Chile, and Codelco, who also said recently that they likely can't sustain production at the levels they've been doing it. And similar to uranium is necessary for the build out of all the technological applications that governments and society want. You want an electric vehicle? You need a lot of copper for the wires to transmit the electricity from the battery. You want to build out new data centers and things for artificial intelligence? Takes a lot of copper wires to get the electricity there from the new sources that are being built. On down the line, right? And again, the U.S. has been content, indeed complacent, in letting other countries, locales, jurisdictions, governments, groups, and entities produce and refine the copper that we need for our country, for our citizens, right? You know, there's a project in Arizona called the Resolution Mine that's been in permitting for a long time, years and years. You've heard me talk about how long it takes to permit projects. I was involved in a gold antimony project that went into permitting the year my daughter was born. She's 9. It just got its permit. 9 years. And this Resolution Mine has just been, you know, a political football going back and forth, hemming and hawing, hedging, indigenous lawsuits, back and forth. It's clear that we need this mine in America, and now it's being fast-tracked again by the Trump administration. And so, you know, if you look at some of the most successful entrepreneurs in the resource space, like Robert Friedland, for example, he's been banging the drum on copper, Rob McEwen, on down the line. And there's a lot of resources in the U.S. and Canada and Mexico as it relates to copper. And it was just added last week, I believe, to the Department of Interior's list of critical resources for 2025. There's currently a Commerce Department investigation happening, a Section 232 investigation into copper and other critical resources as it relates to the security of supply and how that relates to the security of the United States. You'll recall that back in 2019 and 2020, we had a similar Section 232 investigation for uranium that kicked off the nation bull market in that metal. And I expect a similar occurrence to happen in copper as that investigation plays out. And you're starting to see some of these stocks run, certainly as tariffs have come in the news, even though Trump has waffled on them. You know, copper went to $6 a pound back in July when Trump was threatening tariffs on the import of copper. And then he immediately backtracked because somebody whispered in his ear, "Hey, fuckface, if you do that, we're not going to have enough copper to make anything. So you probably shouldn't tariff refined finished products of copper." And he walked that back. But it just goes to show you how critical the copper is and how dependent we are on other countries to get it. What else should I talk about? Gold is obviously the best metal out there, the monetary hedge, the insurance and all that. But I want to stick more to base and critical metals. So let's talk about rare earths for a second. You'll recall that there was a rare earth boom in 2010 and 2011 when China threatened to cut off supplies because of, I believe it was Japanese interference in some territorial waters. And that kicked off a rare earth boom that saw some of the related stocks like Rare Earth Elements, Quest Rare Minerals, Flinders go up thousands of percent. And the U.S. didn't do anything about it. You know, it was a blip. It went up and it went down. People made a lot of money and the U.S. didn't learn its lesson. It was still content to have China refine or process 80-90% of the rare earths that we need. And we need them for defense sensitive technologies, missile guidance systems, jet airplanes, et cetera, electronics that soldiers carry with them in the field. And we don't really produce any of them in the U.S. We didn't then in that first rare earth boom, 2010, 2011, and we still don't now. And of course, as you know, and have likely been following, there's a new trade spat started back in April, May with, China threatening to cut off the supply of rare earth minerals and magnets once again because of the tariff spat with President Trump. And so we've seen the related stocks, specifically MP Materials, go up monumentally over the past 6 months as, you know, this geopolitical threat has trickled all the way down to Wall Street. And now it seems like we're finally starting to get the message, you know, for better or worse, for right or wrong, whether it's socialist or not, the government's now taken a direct stake in MP Materials. They've guaranteed them a price floor for their rare earths in case the Chinese decide to flood the market. And they're not only doing this with MP Materials, there's other companies that is working with the State Department and other groups to bring on new magnet generation facilities for rare earths, whether they're from extraction, rare earth extraction, monzonite clays or hard rock or whatever, or if they're going to be recycled. So the U.S. still doesn't produce any heavy rare earths or heavy rare earth magnets. Apple and MP Materials made an agreement about this a couple of weeks ago. But the infrastructure still has to be built. And that's why the opportunity is still so robust. I've been involved in a couple of rare earths companies that I've been teasing, promoting, and advertising. And the shares have done quite well. One's gone from $4 to $11 in the past couple of months. One's doubled in the past 18 months. That's going to be a recycling rare earth magnets in Texas, likely with support from the State Department. So and again, I have seen this writing on the wall for over a decade, right? Going back to the financial crash, 2008, 9, 10, I sort of sussed out, sniffed out, and indeed staked my career on being a resource baron of the 21st century, just like there were oil barons in previous centuries with the advent of the internal combustion engine. You know, we're now moving to a place, a future, a society where those building blocks aren't just oil and petrochemicals. Those building blocks for the things that we need are what I just ran you through. Uranium for clean energy, copper for energy transmission and grid build out, rare earths for the defense technologies we need to keep our country, citizens, and families safe, and also for the magnets we need for our high-tech gadgets like phones and electric vehicles. The prices have to go up because it costs more to produce and refine those things in the Western world when you're not externalizing the costs of labor and emissions. And it's playing out now in real time. As Dr. Alan G. said in the quote from the beginning of this podcast, he's made 100 times his subscription price on our recommendation. These stocks have been melting up. And where I want to go next is into private placements, because that's where we've generated the highest returns. So I wanted to cover quickly the deals we've done in the past 3 months. We've been averaging about one deal per month, and I want to show you, illustrate for you the types of deals we're doing, the types of returns we're getting, and the types of leverage we have with the warrants we get with those deals. In June, we financed a company called Finex Metals at 22 cents. I'm going to read a little bit, sorry, to drill for high-grade gold in Finland. It's drilling right now. There's other great projects in Finland, like Rupert Resources, for example. Orion is there, ticker AU in on the TSX. And of course, Agnico Eagle's Kittila mine. Now, Finex is drilling now. We financed it in June at 22 cents. And this week, it hit 43 cents. That's up 95% since June on our shares. And we have warrants at 35 cents to buy more. So the warrants are already in the money. 35 cent warrants, 43 cent share price as Finex drills in Finland. In July, we financed a company called Kincora. That was a 30 cent financing. It was a 3 cent financing, but they did a 10 for one rollback. So it's a 30 cent financing. We did that in conjunction with Mr. Rick Rule and Mr. Jeff Phillips, and we agreed to lock up our shares for a year. Those 30 cent shares are trading at $1.48 this week. We're up 393% on those shares since July. It's September. And we also have warrants to buy more at 50 cents. You've heard Rick Rule talk about private placements. You've heard him talk about warrants. We're in the very same deal that he is, on the very same terms. And members of Private Placement Intel are very happy about that. Last month, August, we financed a company called North Shore Uranium, being led by one of the gentlemen who led Azarga Resources, which I talked to you about 22 minutes ago with the Dewey Burdock deposit. And he's now strategically advising North Shore Uranium on an 11 million pound deposit they have in New Mexico that they're testing to see if it's ISR amenable. And if it is, it will likely be worth much more the $10 or $15 million market cap than it's currently trading with. We finance North Shore Uranium at 5 cents per share. Those shares have hit 18 cents since last month, putting us up 260% in less than 30 days. And we have warrants at 10 cents to buy more while shares are at 18 cents. You're picking up what I'm laying down. That's a tripling and a doubling of our money on the last three deals, natural resource deals we did in the past 3 months, June, July, August. And we have a new one open now in September that's drilling for high-grade gold and lithium in the American Midwest on a project that's been owned by the same family for over 100 years, that's never been properly drill tested, that has surface samples of lithium that are five times the known economic grade, and surface samples, channel samples of gold that are over 18 grams per ton over something like 18 meters. That company is drilling right now. We're buying shares privately at 20 cents. It is trading already well above 20 cents. That deal will be open through September 10th for those of you who are interested in participating in private placements with us. That means you're an accredited investor. That means you're high net worth. Look up what that means. There are people on the list, the private placement intel list that you know, that do deals that we put out. I just mentioned two of them. You would know Doug Casey. He's on the list. He's publicly said that he sources deals from us. Other former newsletter writers like Bob Bishop are on the list and participate in deals and are very happy with the upside that we've generated via deals like I just outlined for you, Finex, Concora Copper, and North Shore Uranium. And there's a new one this month. Check out Private Placement Intel. I'll put up links for you to do that. If you want to meet some of these companies in person, I already said that we'd be at the New Orleans Investment Conference in the first week of November. I believe all three of those companies are going to be there, certainly two of them. I would check out the New Orleans Investment Conference. I'll put a link in the description of this podcast so you have a chance to do that. On to the bizarro banter portion of this podcast. We get another wetting of the whistle. This is Bizarro World. We are political here, but mostly anti-political. We're neither left nor right. We are for the common man and woman, the Jose and Maria, as Gerardo likes to say, in Italiano, Giuseppe and Maria. But anyway, we spend a lot of time talking about politics, the Fed, and, left, right, why they don't have your best interest in mind, etc. On down the line, we've talked about Epstein. We did a great episode about that recently. With Rudy Havenstein on as a guest. And oh, by the way, they're still playing dirty tricks. This week they said they released the documents. It was just a re-release of documents that have already been released. Like, they're just jerking your chain with that. But I wanted to get more local today because, well, because I've been talking about Spokane a lot. I've been talking about the homeless problem we have that I believe is a microcosm of problems faced throughout the country. I'm aware of the complex nature of the problem. I'm aware that there was an opioid epidemic. I lost a brother-in-law to that and many friends. I'm aware that there's vast inequality in the country because of the Fed and the politicians that I just spoke about. It's why you need to own the assets, by the way. It's why I do what I do and preach what I preach. But all politics is local. And at the local level, I'm seeing the same shenanigans I've been seeing for over a decade at the national level, particularly as I pay closer attention. So I am of the belief now that many politicians are in dereliction of their duty. They are not doing the will of the people. They don't have your best interests at heart. It's why I rarely vote. It's why I don't support politicians. It's why I chastise them and I point and laugh at them. Here in Spokane, we have a really bad homeless problem. It's gotten significantly worse over the past 2 years after they disbanded a homeless camp that had some 700 people in it. And those folks had nowhere to go except for the city streets of downtown Spokane. And now, in many locations, but centered in a couple locations specifically in Center City, there's vast crime. There's vast human feces on the sidewalks. I found a dildo on the sidewalk the other day walking out of my office. There's encampments. There's all kinds of property crime, drug use, open drug use, etc. Right? And so I'm not trying to sound unempathetic here. Like, I know that they're people. We need to be trying to do the best we can for them. But at the same time, they need to be held to some of the same standards that the rest of society is held to. And more importantly, when in America, in a democracy, a city votes to do something, the leaders in that city need to do the will of the people. So in Spokane, we had a vote to ban homeless camping. 75% of the people who voted supported that. They wanted no camping on the street. They wanted to make it illegal. No warning, nothing. You're camping on the street, you have to get off. That went to the Washington State Supreme Court, who said that it was a legislative issue, not an administrative issue, and so the voters could not pass it. It had to be passed legislatively by the city council. So all the city council had to do was pass it in the form in which it was written, the way it was passed by the people. Did the mayor and the city council do that? No, they did not. They altered, defanged, detoothed the bill that the people voted for, essentially making it not illegal to camp on the sidewalk, giving a warning period, watering it down, injecting other clauses. And then this went to a vote in June in city council. And the mayor wants her version of the bill to pass, the detoothed, defanged, watered down version. Lots of people went to that city council meeting. Lots of people said that they should pass what the people wanted. I think it was like the ratio was like, I don't know, 30 or 40 to 1. People speaking in favor of wanting the Proposition 1 passed the way the people passed it. What happened is, this is kind of funny, the mayor's got a couple lapdogs on the city council, and one of them, who she appointed, by the way, wasn't even elected, voted the wrong way. She voted not to do what the mayor wanted, and so chaos ensued. The meeting went till after midnight. The mayor was calling and texting folks on the city council. Allegedly, we're told, this one city council person who voted the wrong way had previously been promised a job by the mayor in the city administration once her appointed term was up, that was allegedly threatened in the wee hours of that morning in those texts and calls and backroom sessions, threatening to take that city councilwoman job away with the city unless she changed her vote. That's the allegation. We have the texts. We have the calls. There's been a Spokane Ethics Committee investigation opened up, and the paper's not writing about it. And I think the people are fed up. So what you had here is a mayor and a city council who took a city council meeting until the wee hours of the morning, heard from the public what they wanted, and did the exact opposite because that's what their agenda is. This is a very complex issue, I know, but again, all politics is local. There's a lot of nonprofits that benefit, that get payola from the treating of the homeless, the providing of services, and that's the road we're going down, the providing of services. And again, it's not what the people want. And so the mayor was texting people in the wee hours of the morning, and we're going to see how this investigation goes. It should be a much wider story. It should be printed in the Spokesman Review, the local paper here, but it's not. And I would bet you, I don't even have to bet you, I know this is going on in cities and towns across America, because I come from a small town on the East Coast in Maryland, Elkton, Maryland, by the way. And I know the good old boy complex and how it works. It's why I'm an outsider. It's why I'm independent. It's why I provide for myself and my family and don't rely or want to rely on the government to give or do anything for me. But when I see the government, especially at the local level, defying the will of the people, they are in dereliction and bastardization of their duty. This is America. This is a democracy. Elected officials work for the people. They are not to be doing backroom deals to defy the will of the people. It's un-American. It's unethical. And we need to point and laugh when we see it. On to premium portfolio picks. I'm Nick Hodge on behalf of my partner, Gerardo Del Real, and this was the 333rd episode of Investing in Bizarro World. See ya.